Chapter 8. Ascended. He was curled up with his House of Commons boots on his wife's armchair, reading his eternal blue books, when Mrs. N. entered from her apartment, dressed for the evening. Mrs. N. Frederick, won't you come? Mr. N. where? Mrs. N. to Lady Sowerby's. Mr. N. I'd rather go to the Black Hole in Calcutta. Besides, this sanitary report is really the most interesting, he begins to read. Mrs. N. peaked, well, Mr. Titmarsh will go with us. Mr. N. will he? I wish him joy. At this juncture Miss Clarissa Newboy enters in a pink paletot, trimmed with swan's down looking like an angel, and we exchange glances of what shall I say? Of sympathy on both parts, and consummate rapture on mine. But this is by play. Mrs. N. good night, Frederick. I think we shall be late. Mr. N. You won't wake me, I dare say, and you don't expect a public man to sit up. Mrs. N. it's not you, it's the servants. Cocker sleeps very heavily. The maids are best in bed, and are all ill with the influenza. I say, Frederick dear, don't you think you had better give me your chub key? This astonishing proposal, which violates every recognized law of society, this demand which alters all the existing state of things, this fact of a woman asking for a door key, struck me with a terror which I cannot describe, and impressed me with the fact of the vast progress of our street. The door key. What would our grandmothers, who dwelt in this place, when it was a rustic suburb, think of its condition now, when husbands stay at home, and wives go abroad with the latchkey? The evening at Lady Sowerby's was the most delicious we have spent for long, long days. Thus it will be seen, that everybody of any consideration in our street takes a line. Mrs. Minnie Mai, 34, takes the homeopathic line, and has soirees of doctors of that faith. Lady Pocklington takes the capitalist line, and those stupid and splendid dinners of hers are devoured by loan contractors and railroad princes. Mrs. Trimmer, 38, comes out in the scientific line, and indulges us in rational evenings, where history is the lightest subject admitted, and geology and the sanitary condition of the metropolis form the general themes of conversation. Mrs. Brummy plays finely on the bassoon, and has evenings dedicated to Sebastian Bach, and enlivened with Handel. At Mrs. Maskelyne's they are mad for charades and theatricals. They performed last Christmas in a French piece, by Alexander Dumas, I believe, a De Chestamonte fiasco, of which I forget the plot, but everybody was in love with everybody else's wife, except the hero, Don Alonso, who was ardently attached to the Duchess, who turned out to be his grandmother. The piece was translated by Lord Fiddle Faddle, Tom Bulbul being the Don Alonso, and Mrs. Roland Callender, who never misses an opportunity of acting in a piece in which she can let down her hair, was the Duchess. Alonso. You know how well he loves you, and you wonder to see Alonso suffer, Cunegunda? Ask if the chamois suffer, when they feel plunged in their panting sights the hunter's steel, or when the soaring heron or eagle proud, pierced by my shaft, comes tumbling from the cloud, ask if the royal birds know anguish, no, the victims of Alonso's twanging bow. Then ask him, if he suffers him who dies, pierced by the poisoned glance, that glitters from your eyes. He staggers from the effect of the poison, the Duchess. Alonso loves. And whom? His grandmother. Oh, hide me, gracious tomb. Her grace faints away. Such acting as Tom Bulbul's I never saw. Tom lists atrociously, and uttered the passage, you ask me if I suffer, in the most absurd way. Miss Clapperclaw says he acted pretty well, and that I only joke about him, because I am envious, and wanted to act a part myself. I envious indeed. But of all the assemblies, feastings, junketings, dejunes, soirees, conversations, dinner parties, in our street, I know of none pleasanter than the banquets at Tom Fairfax's, one of which this enormous provision consumer gives 7 times a week. He lives in one of the little houses of the old Waddle of Street Quarter. quarter, built long before Pocklington Square and Pocklington Gardens, and the Pocklington family itself had made their appearance in this world. Tom, though he has a small income, and lives in a small house, yet sits down one of a party of 12 to dinner every day of his life, these 12 consisting of Mrs. Fairfax, the 9 Mrs. Fairfax, and Master Thomas Fairfax the son and heir to 2 pence halfpenny a year. It is awkward just now, to go and beg potluck from such a family as this, because, though a guest is always welcome, we are 13 a table, an unlucky number, it is said. This evil is only temporary, and will be remedied presently, when the family will be 13 without the occasional guest, to judge from all appearances. Early in the morning Mrs. Fairfax rises, and cuts bread and butter from 6 o'clock till 8, during which time the nursery operations upon the 9 little Graces are going on. If his wife has to rise early to cut the bread and butter, I warrant Fairfax must be up bedtimes to earn it. He is a clerk in a government office, to which duty he trudges daily, refusing even 2 penny omnibuses. Every time he goes to the shoemaker's he has to order 11 pairs of shoes, and so can't afford to spare his own. He teaches the children Latin every morning, and is already thinking when Tom shall be inducted into that language. He works in his garden for an hour before breakfast. His work over by 3 o'clock, he tramps home at 4, and exchanges his dapper coat for his dressing gown, a ragged but honorable garment. Which is the best, his old coat or Sir John's brand new one? Which is the most comfortable and becoming, Mrs. Fairfax's black velvet gown, which he has worn at the Pocklington Square parties these 12 years, and in which I protest she looks like a queen, or that new robe which the milliner has just brought home to Mrs. Bumpshire's, and into which she will squeeze herself on Christmas Day? Miss Clapperclaw says that we are all so charmingly contented with ourselves that not one of us would change with his neighbor. And so, rich and poor, high and low, one person is about as happy as another in our street. Dr. Birch and His Young Friends by Mr. M. A. Titmarsh, the doctor and his staff. There is no need to say why I became assistant master and professor of the English and French languages, flower painting, and the German flute, in Dr. Birch's academy, at Rodwell Regis. Good folks may depend on this, that it was not for choice, that I left lodgings near London, and a genteel society, for an undermaster's desk in that old school. I promise you the fare at the usher's table, the getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning, the walking out with little boys in the fields, who used to play me tricks, and never could be got to respect my awful and responsible character as teacher in the school, Miss Birch's vulgar insolence, Jack Birch's glum condescension, and the poor old doctor's patronage, were not matters in themselves pleasurable. And that patronage and those dinners were sometimes cruel hard to swallow. Never mind, my connection with the place is over now, and I hope they have got a more efficient undermaster. Jack Birch, Rev. J. Birch, of St. Neots Hall, Oxford, is partner with his father the doctor, and takes some of the classes. About his Greek I can't say much, but I will construe him in Latin any day. A more supercilious little prig, giving himself airs to, about his cousin, Miss Raby, who lives with the doctor. A more empty, pompous little coxcomb I never saw. His white neckcloth looked as if it choked him. He used to try, and look over that starch upon me, and Prince the assistant, as if he were a couple of footmen. He didn't do much business in the school, but occupied his time in writing sanctified letters to the boys' parents, and in composing dreary sermons to preach to them. The real master of the school is Prince, an Oxford man too. Shy, haughty, and learned, crammed with Greek and a quantity of useless learning, uncommonly kind to the small boys, pitiless with the fools and the braggarts, respected of all for his honesty, his learning, his bravery, for he hit out once in a boat row in a way which astonished the boys and the bargemen, and for a latent power about him, which all saw and confessed somehow. Jack Birch could never look him in the face, Old Miss Z dared not put off any of her airs upon him. Miss Rosa made him the lowest of curtsies. Miss Raby said she was afraid of him. Good old Prince. We have sat many a night smoking in the doctor's harness room, whither we retired when our boys were gone to bed, and our cares and canes put by. After Jack Birch had taken his degree at Oxford, a process which he effected with great difficulty, this place, which used to be called Birch's, Dr. Birch's Academy, and what not, became suddenly Archbishop Wigsby's College of Rodwell Regis. They took down the old blue board with the gold letters, which has been used to mend the pixie since. Birch had a large schoolroom run up in the Gothic taste, with statuettes, and a little belfry, and a bust of Archbishop Wigsby in the middle of the school. He put the six senior boys in two caps and gowns, which had rather a good effect as the lads sauntered down the street of the town, but which certainly provoked the contempt and hostility of the bargemen. And so great was his rage for academic costumes and ordinances, that he would have put me myself into a lay gown, with red knots and fringes, but that I flatly resisted, and said that a writing master had no business with such paraphernalia. By the way, I have forgotten to mention the doctor himself. And what shall I say of him? Well, he has a very crisp gown and bands, a solemn aspect, a tremendous loud voice, and a grand air with the boy's parents, whom he receives in a study covered round with the best bound books, which imposes upon many, upon the women especially, and makes them fancy that this is a doctor indeed. But law bless you! He never reads the books, or opens one of them, except that in which he keeps his bands, a Dugdale's Anasticon, which looks like a book, but is in reality a cupboard, where he has his port, almond cakes, and decanter of wine. He gets up his classics with translations, or what the boys call cribs. They pass wicked tricks upon him, when he hears the forms. The elder wags go to his study, and ask him to help them in hard bits of Herodotus or Thucydides. He says he will look over the passage, and flies for refuge to Mr. Prince, or to the crib. He keeps the flogging department in his own hands, finding that his son was too savage. He has awful brows and a big voice. But his roar frightens nobody. It is only a lion skin, or, so to say, a muff. Little Mordaunt made a picture of him with large ears, like a well-known domestic animal, and had his own justly boxed for the caricature. The doctor discovered him in the fact, and was in a flaming rage, and threatened whipping at first, but in the course of the day an opportune basket of game arriving from Mordaunt's father, the doctor became mollified, and has burnt the picture with the ears. However, I have one wafered up in my desk by the hand of the same little rascal. The cock of the school. I am growing an old fellow, and have seen many great folks in the course of my travels and time. Louis Philippe coming out of the Tuileries, His Majesty the King of Prussia, and the Reichsverweser accolading each other at Cologne at my elbow, Admiral Sir Charles Napier in an omnibus once, the Duke of Wellington, the immortal Guy de Twamer, the late benevolent Pope Gregory XVI, and a score more of the famous in this world to whom whenever one looks at, one has a mild shock of awe and tremor. I like this feeling and decent fear and trembling with which a modest spirit salutes a great man. Well, I have seen generals capering on horseback at the head of their crimson battalions, bishops sailing down cathedral aisles, with downcast eyes, pressing their trencher caps to their hearts with their fat white hands, college heads when Her Majesty is on a visit, the doctor in all his glory at the head of his school on speech day. A great sight and all great men these. I have never met the late Mr. Thomas Cribb, but I have no doubt should have regarded him with the same feeling of awe with which I look every day at George Champion, the cock of Dr. Birch's school. When, I say, I reflect as I go up, and set him a sum, that he could whop me in 2 minutes, double up Prince and the other assistant, and pitch the doctor out of window, I can't but think how great, how generous, how magnanimous a creature this is, that sits quite quiet and good-natured, and works his equation, and ponders through his Greek play. He might take the schoolroom pillars and pull the house down if he liked. He might close the door and demolish every one of us, like Andor the lover Eribla, but he lets us live. He never thrashes anybody without a cause, when woe betide the tyrant or the sneak. I think that to be strong and able to whop everybody, not to do it, mind you, but to feel that you were able to do it, would be the greatest of all gifts. There is a serene good humor which plays about George Champion's broad face, which shows the consciousness of this power, and lights up his honest blue eyes with a magnanimous calm. He is Invictus. Even when a cup there was no beating this lion. 6 years ago the undaunted little warrior actually stood up to Frank Davison, the Indian officer now poor little Charlie's brother, whom Miss Raby nursed so affectionately. Then 17 years old, and the cock of birches. They were obliged to drag off the boy, and Frank, with admiration and regard for him, prophesied the great things he would do. Legends of combats are preserved fondly in schools. They have stories of such at Rodwell Regis, performed in the old doctor's time, 40 years ago. Champion's affair with the young Tutbury Pet, who was down here in training, with Black the Bargeman, with the three head boys of Dr. Wapshot's academy, whom he caught maltreating an outlying day boy of ours, and C, are known to all the Rodwell Regis men. He. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.